Right now it is time for the Media Beat with David Taratruk. David joins us every Friday morning. David, of course, has his own website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And thank God for the Christmas and Hanukkah holidays, because there's not as much commotion coming out of Washington as one normally would have the past 3 years. Really, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But I still want to say this is indeed David Taratruk, and I approve this message.
That's right. Well, yeah, that's it.
I say that as we draw to the end of a pre-election year and come close to stepping into what is a full-fledged election year, 2020, we can look forward to a lot more politicking and media attempting to do its best in a time of really divisive and difficult politics.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because two things I wanted to lead off about. And one is what happened in Israel. Once again, Bibi survives to lead his party and will once again
Netanyahu, as he is known, yes.
And he's going to run for election again. This will be, what, the third election in the past, what, 4 months or 5 months?
Uh-huh.
Wow. That's even a little crazier than what happened in with Brexit, and really what's going on with in this country with the elections.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's the Israelis can be counted on for picturesque infighting when it comes to coalition forming, and it seemed pretty clear that Netanyahu couldn't form a coalition, although, you know, best efforts were put into that, as there always are after basically somewhat indecisive elections on the part of the electorate as a whole. But the fact that he's managed to quash a rebellion internally in his Likud party now means that he's going to have to go back to the drawing board. But, of course, he's still in charge of his own party. And at least the worst option for him has been avoided. He struggles on. He's got that Teflon Don aspect to his makeup now, not unlike our own Teflon Don in the White House.
We'll switch over just briefly to our elections, because I received a couple of emails over the weekend because we've had a couple of strange things happen here. When Mayor Bloomberg announced he was going to run for president, he immediately spent $35 million, dollars,
yep,
on ad buys. And wouldn't you know it, within a week?
Without a doubt, the 2020 election is going to be the most expensive in history. But, I mean, we say that about every election, every 4 years, don't we?
And that $35 million bought him 5% in the polls right away. If anything ever shows you how corrupt big money is in politics, and I'm not saying Michael Bloomberg's corrupt because he's following all the rules, but there's an example what – if somebody has a ton of money and they want to spend $35 million as an initial down payment on their campaign, and they can do it, and they can bypass candidates that have been running for the past year in a matter of days, it shows what's wrong with big money.
We have two billionaires contending still in the field of Democratic hopefuls for the presidential nomination, and already they have spent more together than was spent in the entire 2016 election altogether by all candidates then. And as you say, Bloomberg's spending has been concentrated in just a few weeks. And it's paying off. Money talks in our electoral system. And it's, of course, I mean, if we want that kind of politics to distinguish America, then we've gotten exactly what we want. But it doesn't ring true to the principles of American democracy, does it?
No, and it's one of the problems that the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, created, which opened up the door for backdoor, unseen money by the billions to flow into to campaigns who want it. So whether people want to believe it or not, that much money in politics is bad, whether it comes from lobbyists or whether it comes from hidden donors.
The judicial process towards having all this extraordinary amount of money sluicing around in the system, of course, is the notion that corporations are people, and that this is an issue of individual free speech. It's not free speech at all. It's very, very expensive speech. and that's what is true. Money talks, as I say. And if we want it, then, it looks like we've got it. And I think who knows how best to deal with it. But it's certainly not a good way to start into a new decade and a new electoral contest, which is going to be bitter and divisive, and of course, all the money in the world is going to be directed towards it.
You know, it's very interesting. People react now to the amount of money being spent, and I think they react because Bernie Sanders raised so much money from individual donors the last time he ran, and now it appears that come the first couple of weeks of January, they'll report their last quarter, and it appears that he will be around 5 million individual donors, which is staggering if you consider that they send in about $20 a month. And people that think that Bernie Sanders is going to go away, he's not. Now, that money is minuscule compared to what everybody else is spending, but it is an amazing thing for Bernie Sanders. And it even erupted in the last debate when Mayor Pete and Elizabeth Warren got into a fight over there about donations. And I don't know if you saw the news story about Pete Buttigieg, about what his campaign is doing, because they want to lower the amount per donor that they have. They're running a contest with their donors. The person that donates the lowest amount of money.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
And I got upset when I saw that.
Yeah, the Sanders example is a very telling contrast, and Buttigieg is clearly feeling the impact of Bernie Sanders' success. And although if you count down from the vast amounts of the two billionaires in the race have been spending, the next biggest spender is Buttigieg himself, and of course it's having its very helpful effect on his campaign. He's up there in the first four now, backed by these basically very rich people who are backing him. So it's in his interest to try and emulate the Sanders effect if he can. But it doesn't have the same ring of, of authenticity that Sanders does.
And it's taken my view of him down a little bit. I mean, I still think I agree with him on a lot of things, but it's brought my view of him down a little bit when you have to do that. And I think all of a sudden, David, you could have sat up until this week. You would never see a story about Bernie Sanders anyplace. It just didn't come up unless it was on his website. Well, now, in the past week, CNN, Time, and also the New York Times, and CNBC and Business Weekly all came out with stories, and Politico, that now the Democratic National Committee is concerned because Bernie Sanders continually polls in second place now, only about 8 or 9 points behind Joe Biden in national polls. And when you combine that with what Elizabeth Warren has, all of a sudden the Democratic National Committee is appearing to lose control of the process on who they want to run.
Yeah, strong echoes again of the 2015-2016 run-up towards that election, when the DNC was severely rattled by the Sanders phenomenon. The Sanders phenomenon is reflective of something very real, certainly on the blue tinge end of the political spectrum. It's a counter phenomenon to big money talking that we've just been reflecting on. Lots of small donations, many extraordinary number of small donations that he's managed to pull off, and what a counterbalance to the big money talking phenomenon. It's bound to rattle conventional politics like the DNC.
Well, here's a good example. I never ever donated to a political campaign in my life until Bernie Sanders started running in 2016. I have continually since 2016 sent $27 a month, first to the Sanders campaign, next to his foundation, Your Revolution, and now then back to this campaign. That's $27 a month. It's one meal out at a restaurant. To me, it's worth it. And I think what people are starting to see about Bernie Sanders and what makes him so likable is that he hasn't changed in 35 years. People know who he is. They know whether they like his policies or not, but they also know that he's a pretty nobody. I mean, he carries probably the most significant name recognition and good feeling of any candidate to run, probably since Barack Obama.
Yeah, heart attack notwithstanding, yeah. Occupying a political place on the spectrum that many people consider to be that strange word in American in lingo of, you know, a socialist with a capital S. He's nonetheless pulled off something that would have been unthinkable in previous election cycles. You've got to hand it to the guy. And then the next question comes up automatically with every political commentator. Is he electable? And then, you know, you start to see the usual fracturing of opinion-making, of the opinion-making machine on that issue. It's a sad reflection that we have to, consider such a phenomenon as somehow peculiar, which I think is, you know, he's still put under the microscope by the commentariat as something weird and outlandish and almost un-American, although that word's not often been used about him. But he is very reflective of a very genuine movement in American politics, which counters, I'm glad to say, the big money phenomenon.
You see all these political arguments in social media, which is crazy. And finally, I said to somebody, if you're so anti-socialist, why are you participating in social media?
Socialist and social are not the same.
I mean,
except that they can be daubed on the same brush all the time, as they often are.
It's amazing to watch. And whether Bernie Sanders is electable or not I don't concern myself in that, because it's right now it's not to that point. I happen to believe it is, but I'm no political expert, but I do think he has made a difference in what the Democratic Party talks about, and he cannot be. People are trying to compare him to Corbyn. It's not the same animal, not the same animal at all.
Jeremy Corbyn of the Labour Party in Britain.
Yeah.
Well, no, and in some ways, he's a better socialist than Jeremy Corbyn. But that's an arcane argument that I don't think it's valuable to go into.
Yeah.
It's that media effort amongst, as I say, the commentariat, who seem to try to paint Sanders as somehow outlandish. I mean, he's not. He's very reflective of an American tradition. Whether or not he gets the nomination, and I think it's rather unlikely, but he's certainly shifted the political political center of gravity, as it were, in this whole process for the Democrats. And without him, I would argue that we wouldn't even have Buttigieg, even though he occupies a different point on the spectrum.
It is the media beat, of course. We are now at that time where you really can try to reflect on the year that has almost gone by in just a matter of days, and what awaits us in the future. And David, what awaits us in the future behind that curtain is at all at one time scary, exciting, and dangerous.
Sure. It was interesting to reflect on some of the non-political, except that it has huge political implications, a development that has happened in the last few months with an official imprimatur. We've got a Department of Government shifting its main policy focus in a way that I don't think the White House is at all in favor of. They don't like the sound of it. They don't like the feel of it. They don't like what it says about them. The Trumpists in control is what the people I'm referring to. And that's the Department of Homeland Security coming around to the recognition, long overdue, I think, in the view of many analysts of security issues, that the biggest threat to American security at the moment, as far as the DHS is concerned, is not international terrorism anymore. It's internal, domestic terrorism. And by that, of course, we mean, on the whole, the vast majority of internal terrorism acts are carried out by, you know, to use value judgments about it, crazy right-wing lunatics. It's a recognition that those on the ground, certainly those involved in law enforcement and the enforcement and the maintenance of national security, have known for an awful long time that there's something about the fringes of the American right, which are getting enormous boosts out of the political climate of the moment, the nasty, extreme political climate and the divisiveness of it. And it's now a very serious matter that law enforcement people, operatives and intelligence operators in that field take very, very seriously indeed. And as you say, that's I think one of the pointed ends of the new atmosphere that we're going into the election year of 2020 with.
And you have to you term all the domestic upheaval. The president next year is going to have to face that. He's going to have to face the Hong Kong crisis. He's going to have to face what's going on in the Middle East. He's going to have to face North Korea. He's going to have to face what's going on with Brexit and the EU. He's going to have to face, because we're a world power, what's going to happen with Northern Ireland, what's going to happen with Scotland. I mean, these are just... I mean, I rattled things off in the past 10 seconds that are just phenomenal problems.
Oh, you left out the whole of Latin America, which is seething.
Yeah.
Apart from, there's still seething, but of course it's being tamped down very effectively in Brazil. But otherwise, yes, another continent in a state of an extraordinary tumult, like much of the rest of the world. Yeah, and America still remains the unipolar superpower, and we'll have to have a coherent and sensible, we hope, way of reacting to that new reality of international politics, and it's a turbulent world, and we have at the moment a rather turbulent figure as a figurehead of our own nation, and that's not a necessarily good match. And what we do about it over the next 11 months is going to be decisive.
What's interesting and what makes it even more dangerous is that to want to have a president that doesn't want to send your children or grandchildren to war is one thing, but to have a president who really does believe that we should withdraw from everything in the world, and this America First is a great slogan, but you can't, in today's world, you just can't operate that way. It's a whole different world than it was before the United Nations and before the EU. You cannot withdraw from so many different treaties and organizations. Especially at this time in the world when there's just so much going on?
Well, it's withdrawing and it's withdrawing. I mean, it's very difficult to interpret what Trump means. And of course, the media's job much of the time is to try and interpret what he means. It's a fateful task, but there it is. And when he says we need to be out of what appear to be senselessly endless wars. That's one thing, but withdrawal is something that he appears to want to do, and at the same time he will take interventionist steps, usually of a disconcerting and turbulence increasing kind, and you have a total lack of coherence. The rest of the world, and this is something that I concern myself with a lot as mainly an internationalist in my reporting over the years, and now it's a particularly difficult exercise to work out, if you're part of that rest of the world, quite how to interpret what the leader of the free world, as we used to call the occupant of that office, is all about. What is he trying to do? I mean, he seems to have a government by diktat and by slogans. What does America First actually mean? It's becoming less and less clear, not more and more clear as we pass the 3-year mark for his presidency.
And I'm going to jump in here and say I would fantasist, of course, but I would have been a heck of a lot happier if the past 3 years hadn't been spent focusing, on it's a disaster, just in terms of coverage, to another, we're all going to die, and a little more time. I mean, obviously, it wouldn't have been as profitable, but I think you've exhausted your electorate, but never mind. And more time had been spent trying to, instead of dumb down the nuance of exactly what you're talking about, David, it would have been really nice if someone had made an attempt to say, now look, let's take a step, step back or a step up overview, and like, all right, this is what's being said, this is what's being done. Hey, wow, what a disconnect. Or, oh, this is, but no. We didn't have that. We just had one group screaming that the end of the world was nigh, and the other group saying no, it isn't. And that's
sure,
pretty
and,
much
and
what it's
you've
broken
got
down
a,
to.
A massive demonstration over the last 3 years of TDS, Trump Derangement Syndrome, hard at work, very much in progress.
It's now a thing
in the media, and it's now a thing that even Trump himself talks about with some pride.
But you
somehow or other, I've driven people crazy, and I'm proud of it. It makes the case even more strongly for a media approach which is calm and reflective, and attempts to say, well, what could this actually mean in real terms, rather than just, as you say, run around like a headless chicken complaining about it all.
And I don't, I look for the grown-ups and these, you'll forgive me, the industry leaders to say, hey, we need some of this, especially, and again, it won't happen. It's just, it's fantasies, but I am struck.
Well, it happens, but those calm, reflective voices are drowned out by the screaming for attention.
It's not even
the media is also engaged in.
But it's not even that. It's like when the president does something completely wacko, like the windmill 10-minute statement that he got into, things like that. And I'm not criticizing
wacko
him for
is
it.
A gentle way of putting it, I think. Yeah.
But when the president of the United States goes on like that and rambles on, and it's almost like he's thinking this as he's talking. It opens up the door.
Thinking? Oh, that's a good word for it. Thinking. Yes.
But it opens up the door for all these theories. I mean, he has no, unlike most other presidents, he has no staff around him that can protect him from that. He's not protectable. There's not a staff in the world that he could hire because he doesn't listen to them.
All right, there's no question that you're right, but here's the problem. And I just saw it on NBC this morning, and I was really struck. Each in everything that everyone said, including Al Sharpton, Willie Geist, everybody there, Mike Barnicle, each person had to say, and there's a real good chance that he's going to get reelected. Each person had to say that this morning. Now, well, I know that we're just moving right into the next year and we're going to run out of time, but I was more struck by that than anything else because, let's call it the management of information, now you've got to deal with uh-oh.
Sure. In a turbulent world, it's very likely that very little sticks. The Teflon Don illusion I made before you joined us, Jill, remains. Everybody has to say, in every codicil, in every sentence now, the subordinate clause has to be, and there's a good chance he will be returned to office.
Well.
That's what we reap after we've sown this confusion narrative, this hysterical narrative of the last 3 years.
Well, I'll just wrap it up with this. 4 years ago, the same media was saying he could never possibly be elected.
Absolutely.
Well,
so it goes, as Walter Cronkite used to say occasionally when he didn't have anything else to say. And we're in exactly that position now.
Let's bring it back. So it goes. Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, The Media Beat.